through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Welcome to a Friday edition of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. We got a dynamite program for you today. We're actually going to speak to John Clayton. How about that? The professor at 1 o'clock on the Zeke's Pizza Hotline. And as we do every day at 2 o'clock, our Seahawks free agent profile. Today, the biggest one of all, Jadeveon Clowney. So, that's coming up at 2 o'clock. But first, we got a little bit of good old-fashioned class warfare to discuss here. This whole thing with the CBA yesterday. You know, it's funny. The news initially trickled out 2 days ago having to do with what the owners want to do to the season and to the playoffs. And as fans, we can all immediately react to that stuff, right? Because it affects how we ingest the season, how we care about it. Oh, you know, another week that, you know, that affects how we keep track of the standings, maybe my fantasy team, playoffs, gambling, etc. But as you dig through this, the actual presented CBA that the owners want the players to sign, it's now turned into something other than just a couple of scheduling novelties. It comes down to percentages and how much the owners get, how much the players get, and what's fair to the players, how much the fans should care about all this stuff. And it's funny, as the four of us actually were in Kyle's office this morning discussing this topic, the degree to which you care about this issue and the side you take really depends on who you are and your own life situation. Like, I'm imagining a mother and a father who have, like, four kids who are, you know, they're making ends meet, but for the most part, they're living check to check and they're putting food on the table. Maybe they can afford one Seahawk game a year. Maybe they can afford a couple of XFL games. But they jump on ESPN.com or 710sports.com and they read about all this stuff and they say, okay, this is billionaires fighting millionaires. Where do I fit into this? Do I fit into it at all? Should I care? And if I do, who should I back? You know, and it's, I guess, for that person, for that group of people. And by the way, I'll count myself amongst that group of people. I'm not wealthy even a little bit. So when I look at millionaires fighting billionaires over percentages and I see a theoretical injustice, I can point at that and say, well, you know, maybe this should be tweaked a little bit. But the degree to which I actually care and want to come on these airwaves and fight for one side or the other, it's very hard for me to do.
Well, and I can understand that, and I can understand that perspective. And for most, I wouldn't say most fans, I don't want to lump a large group of people together, but I can understand that perspective, or people not really getting on the bandwagon of this or looking at the players and saying how much money they make, and so therefore they're greedy, they're this and that. They're not appreciative. They're making millions of dollars already. Why should I care if they make more millions of dollars, right? And it's an interesting conversation that I just look at, and I find it interesting from the standpoint of so many people out there. You have a hard time relating to this situation because of the dollars, the amount of money, all of that, but I find it interesting that people tend to agree in a lot of cases with the ownership and then the player, when in a lot of cases, most people would in normal workforce situations say that you got to stick it to the man. It's the workforce versus management versus owners. It's like Amazon, right? Amazon and Jeff Bezos. And you know, we're going to make Amazon great. We're going to do these things to help make Amazon a lot more money and Jeff Bezos a lot more money. But guess what? You as the employee, you don't get to see the benefit of that. You don't get to see your pay raise increased, and we're going to ask you to do even more, right? Like, so that part of it is interesting when you put it into that perspective, because I look at this situation in the current CBA right now, or the one that is being offered and pushed onto the players by the owners, and it's laughable from the standpoint of the amount of revenue that is actually going to come to the players in the amount of time frame, and it's not even close to being worth it when you talk about adding two more games to their possible schedule, one for sure in week 17, and you're trying to, you know, convince me as a player, as an active player, right, that this is good for you. We're going to give you more of this. And in most aspects, it's not. And it's being pushed so hard on them. It's interesting to look at that and go, you know what? You guys, the player, you're being selfish. You're being greedy. Anybody could come onto this field and go and play this game. You know, you guys should be grateful for what you're getting.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the undertone that I'm hearing from people about the negotiations as they're ongoing. And it's interesting that you guys say, kind of point that out, that in a normal setting, either Tom, you said it's hard for me to empathize with a fight between millionaires and billionaires, and Jake saying, well, in most cases, you know, in any other labor dispute happening, most people tend to side against management because everyone can kind of empathize with being on the side of a worker. And I do think that the money of the income of the highest paid players in the NFL makes it difficult for some people to empathize. But I don't think that means that you shouldn't. And if you don't, fine. If you just want this to be resolved so that you can make sure you can watch your favorite team or your favorite sport or a sport you care about and you're passionate about, fine. You're not a bad person for wanting that. And I want to make that clear. But I would encourage you as a football fan to care about how this is unfolded and whether or not players are getting a fair shake at this, because it is an incredibly lucrative industry, the NFL and pro football. And I think that some of what the players are asking for is it's feasible for the NFL owners to do and still make money and still be profitable and still be able to run their own franchises. But there's so much power that the NFL owners have in comparison to the players that there's no real incentive for them to budge. And I think that that's a situation that is easy to empathize with in itself. And I also think that sometimes that lack of just general care about what happens to this, part of it's like the legalese, the language. I mean, I'm looking at a bulleted list of just a fact sheet for the CBA proposal. It's still hard for me to understand. And I've been looking at it and highlighting it and trying to understand it. It's hard to take away what this really offers players when you don't have context.
I started reading through this list, Stacey, that you gave me, and all of a sudden I found myself thinking about sailing. Oh, the weather's so nice. I want to go out of my cabin.
Right, exactly. See, I do that. I'm looking at this, and then I slowly transition to my phone. Pretty soon I'm on Instagram, and I'm like, what was I doing? Reading the CBA fact sheet. But I think there are a couple things. One, some of the things that the players want are important things that you should want players to have. If you're in an industry that could cause bodily harm, I want to make sure that your union ensures that you have good healthcare coverage for your life. That's important to me, right? And everyone has family members that have worked in that kind of industry. And if you are an incredibly talented person, if you're someone who can do something very few people in the world can, I would love for you to be compensated for your worth and what you bring to the table. I can't be an NFL player. I don't think anyone I know can be an NFL player. It's a really hard thing to do. And it is a very lucrative industry, and you should be able to be entitled to what you're worth. And I just think that I would encourage people, which is what I'm trying to do, to remove yourself from just the number and the salary that the top players are getting paid, and just understand that this is a labor dispute. And when you look at it that way, I think it's easier to side with the players.
Okay, I'm going to offer a counterpoint to that, a direct counterpoint.
Okay.
Because you're asking people to remove the numbers. I don't think that it's fair to ask the average person to divorce the numbers from the situation.
Sure.
And here's why. Like, we use these terms labor and management as if you can apply those terms to every single dispute across the board. I don't think you can do that. When you have people who are making $15 an hour and those people are looking for better wages against their management, that's a little bit different. I think the average person, myself included, looks at a football player or a millionaire, we'll say, forget about the fact that they're a football player, looks at a millionaire and says, you know what? If they argue for so many more millions and get more millions, their lifestyle isn't going to change nearly as much as mine will, even if I end up getting like $15,000 more.
But how would the
year.
Owner's lives change? And I see people commenting and being like, oh, well, the owners had to work. A lot of these owners inherited their money.
That's true. But hold on. I don't agree with the assumption that not sympathizing with the players is automatically backing up the owners. I think that first of all, I'm not really sure that the fans have an effect on any of this unless they just stop watching. So if you say, well, you're a fan and you're siding with management, so what? What effect does that have on all this?
It doesn't have an effect because ultimately it comes down to the players. It comes down to the ownership. But also, I'll actually counter what I just said. There is a reason why the NFL and NFL ownership has pushed this so hard through the media. It is to get fan support for the excitement of a 17th game. It is to get and generate the excitement for these playoff games, right? Like, that's what people, a normal average fan, is going to gravitate to, focus on, and want to have happen or not want to have happen. But the CBA part of it is actually the thing that's going to make or break this situation. The NFL can add the playoffs to it with regardless of the CBA, but week 17, you have to have the direct approval of you have to come to an agreement with this collective bargaining situation. And I see this as one place where the ownership in this situation understands the value of this moment, and they are trying to capitalize on it in a big, big way. And if they can push or put pressure on the NFL players to cave in or make concessions early, then they have a chance to win not just now, but big time in maybe even 3 years from now.
I don't understand how signing this thing now matters one iota to any fan. I mean, if you think that they're fighting this thing through the media and they're putting this out trying to drum up support through the fans, what fan is going to be so excited about an extra playoff game or an extra regular season game where they're gonna tweet at Richard Sherman better sign this now?
I think that the way it's being used through the media is to make sure that fans see players as being selfish because they're very visible.
Right.
And because people can look at it and say, why should I feel bad for you, but the difference between you getting $250,000 in a game? Well, because you can do something that few other people can do. I'm not complaining if an engineer makes more money than I do.
But before we go to three questions, the direct example I'll give you is the contract negotiations that happened with Russell Wilson. Why is there back and forth between NFL team and NFL player, right? The NFL team is trying to put pressure on a player in a situation to take less or to have that player perceived as being selfish for wanting that contract. Dak Prescott, Emmitt Smith, right? There's these conversations go on that paint the player in a certain light and can misconstrue what the contract negotiations are, right? The same thing for the player itself, right? So there's all that back and forth that's going on. This isn't any different. It's just on a greater scale, grander scale. There's not one individual name attached to it. It's the entire NFL player.
Management, management, management. Three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we got to protect the kids" nonsense.
All right, we kind of just answered this, or we addressed it. If you don't side with the players, does that automatically mean you side with management?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, Tom, you view this as no. I don't really understand how it couldn't be. I'm not saying you're adamantly, like you're passionately siding with the owner, but you're just you're indifferent in a way, I guess. And so I just see this as, if you don't you don't empathize, or not empathize, but if you're not understanding where the player's coming from, you're like, who cares what they think? I think that that feeds into where the owners are coming from.
What if you understand both sides? Instead of saying, I don't understand either side, what if I say, I understand both sides?
Then
fair.
Then I can say fair. You're just choosing not to add your voice into the conversation. But most society, and as passionate as fans are, they're going to throw their weight around or throw their opinion
they're
one way or the other.
Uninformed opinions.
Well, no, but I am in general surprised by how many people are like mad at players. Or even like if I look at our text line right now in 710-710, if you want to join our conversation. There are so many people that are like, Stacey, you're crazy. Players get paid so much money. This is how it is in a business. If you don't like it, leave. Like that kind of sentiment. I'm just surprised. I'm surprised that there aren't more people saying like, yeah, why not? What's the difference? Just give them, you know, their money if they're asking for it, or give them healthcare if they're asking for it, or whatever. It's weird how many people, I would say the vast majority of people, are just even tacitly siding with owners.
By the way, I want to make very clear, issues of post-career healthcare.
Yeah, it's important.
I am adamantly on the side of the players. And I wrote that article I wrote the other day. I'm against expanding the schedule. I'm against expanding the playoffs. So I guess you can call me anti-management in those senses. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, management is going to preserve the game I love. And the players are only going to screw it up by wanting guaranteed contracts and things like that.
Well,
Let's move on. Next.
Number two.
Guys, we talked a lot yesterday on the show about patchwork players. Remember that?
Yes.
Any interest in Damon Snacks Harrison?
Absolutely.
The run-stuffing specialist defensive tackle.
Yeah.
And by the way, does he qualify as a patchwork guy at this point?
Yeah, he does. Because you're not going to sign him to a two-year deal. You're not going to sign him to a three-year deal. You're going to sign him to a one-year deal and try and get the most out of him. And, you know, for Damon Snacks Harrison, this is an opportunity to really have a chance to play for a team like the Seahawks or any other team out there that is trying to get to a Super Bowl. And for him, he made $9+ million last year with the Detroit Lions. I don't believe he's going to command that same type of salary. I think he would probably command somewhere around like 4 or 5 in this case. And if that is the situation, I would hope the Seahawks would be all over that, because, you know, the defensive tackle position is a place where you can afford to do patchwork. You need to spend most of your resources on the edge, and interior wise, you can have a guy like Damon Harrison, who is a great run stuffer, who can help in the interior, be a great leadership presence, a guy that loves the game. Fights, you know, every single time he's out there, he would just be a great presence and a great guy to get for the Seahawks in this situation.
I think this is, I agree with Jake. I think it's a totally fine example of a patchwork player being okay. If you bring in, especially if you bring in an edge rusher on some kind of long-term deal, whether it's Clowney, whether you draft someone you're really happy with, whether it's another free agent that isn't Clowney that's still really promising, I think that's a player where you want a long-term contract. Bringing in someone else on the line is, I think, fine for a short-term thing.
Do you guys think the fact that he has a nickname might earn him some extra bucks?
I love that nickname. I'm obsessed.
Yeah, like he's a famous player because of that.
He's a recognizable player.
And he was a great player at one point. I mean, maybe the best run stuffer in the league.
For sure. And he was he's a dynamic personality. I mean, I was teammates with him for a short period of time when I was with the Jets. And he was there. And, man, he was such a fun guy to be around. Just the life of the party. Great individual. Made things light. Made things fun. But was extremely active during practice and in games. And so, you know, for that reason, I think he would be a great veteran presence to have around. And when we talk about patchwork, it would be that one-year deal, you know, and I think he could fit perfectly in that situation.
Three.
Number three.
Do you guys think all players feel the same way about the CBA?
No. I think it ranges all across the board. I think even for guys at the bottom of the rosters that are just trying to crack the rosters or practice squad players, things of that nature, you're viewing it differently from the standpoint of what benefits me. If you're the top, you're viewing it as to what benefits you, right? And so you have a wide range of different individuals. I think for guys at the bottom of the roster, there's a lot more sentiment in terms of understanding why the top half of the players are upset and why it's not a good deal. And hopefully you can be that guy one day, right? Like, that's the ultimate hope, is that if given the chance, you can become that. But you also got to look out for your situation now. And I think that there is a wide disparity when you really pull all across the NFL and NFL locker rooms because of that reason, because of those, the difference between the top half of the roster and the bottom half of the roster is so big.
Nothing?
I'm mostly just going over our reactions and to all of kind of Jake's perspective from what it looks like from a player point of view. So I do see some more people saying, okay, like, yeah, I kind of get that. And I think that it adds a little more intrigue to how the majority of NFLPA members will vote, because if the reps are some of the highest paid players who very much care if half of their paycheck is gone in week 17, I think Jake's perspective makes it clear that there are a lot of players who think, wow, that extra $3,000 a year for a practice squad is what's going to affect me, and that's really intriguing. I'm mostly still shocked at how many people are legitimately mad at defending players. It's surprising to me.
Please
don't be mad at me.
I admit it is the only example when it comes to just...
It's weird.
Not just NFL, but sports, really. I guess there's a point where, depending on how much labor is earning... There's a tipping point where your average Joe
will stop
siding with them because their lifestyle is too different
and
from
it's,
mine.
And it's fine, and I get it. But again, it is a skill that is incredibly rare in an industry that pays a lot for that skill. And the going rate at the job that person has, again, that very few people in the world can do, is what it is. And it's a lot more money than I'm going to make in my lifetime, but I'm not angry at someone for saying that guy has a right to ask for what he's worth, or that guy has a right to say, if we're going to add an extra two games, then let's do a 50-50 revenue split.
Right.
Because we're bringing in 80% of the revenue because of our level of play and our talent. And I don't know, I think I can see why you would disagree with both sides. I'm just surprised at some of the genuine, like, anger that I'm seeing at an opinion that players have a point.
Well,
it's surprising.
It comes down to a simple fact from players' perspective. That two things, that they talk about the overall lifespan of the CBA. It's 10 years. A lot changes in 10 years. And so when you talk about the overall growth or the percentages of increased revenue, it's not enough to get anybody that's currently playing at this current time to get on board and get excited about.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense to any one of these players right now. And the ultimate goal is to settle that and also to take care of future guys and guys that have played in the past, by making sure retirement benefits, healthcare benefits, all those things are where they need to be. And that's really what it comes down to.
Mikey Salke is in next, talking about all this with us, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy brought to you by Car Toys Labor Management. Labor management. We're talking class warfare today on the program. Mike, where do you stand?
Well, I don't know. Is this Bernie? Like, wait, class warfare? Do we need a revolution? Kyle, give me some of your Bernie Sanders. Come on. Where's some of that Bernie?
This money is going to trickle down to the Nick Ballors, to the Tyler Otts of the roster. We're going to take care of everyone.
So angry.
Do you think that this 17-game thing and the added playoff teams are just a distraction for the fans from what the owners really want?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. The owners, anytime the owners actually talk about what they want, they look bad. The owners only care about one thing. There's only one thing they want, and it's money. There is nothing else. The owners don't have any other agenda items. Seriously.
Yeah.
They just want money. Uh-huh. They don't care how it comes in. They want to continue to grow because they want money. That's it. No, that's it. The only thing, they don't want anything else. They are in it for money, which I think is the grossest thing about NFL owners, really all owners.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that they want to add a an extra wild card game and a game 17, not for the fan experience.
No, it's not.
Not for
that.
The benefit of the player, no. But you're telling me that they want more money?
I think it might be.
Suck. Come
I think,
on, I think man.
And here's the shame of the whole thing for me. If you own a professional sports team, you already have an ungodly amount of money. You already have more money than anyone could ever spend in a lifetime if you own a professional sports team.
But don't they deserve to have 52% of the revenue, Saul?
I just don't.
But they're letting them pass. They're taking away the marijuana suspensions.
So everything's
Isn't
fine.
Isn't that enough?
Jeez. They're going to win because they're the owners and the union is weak. We talked about it yesterday. But I've always felt like if you were going to own a team, why do you need it as a money-making venture? You're already making money through something else if you're wealthy enough to own a football team. Why does the football team need to make more and more money each year? Why can't it just be for fun? Like if I had, you know, how much money does some of these owners have? If I had $4 billion, I'd just be happy breaking even on my football team. Just break even. Just don't lose a ton of money. Break even. And I'll be happy because I get to own a football team, which is a fun thing. It's you ever watch that show Billions?
Mm-hmm.
So remember, like, I think it's the second season of Billions. He's trying to buy, I think, the New York Giants at the
All
time.
All I know from Billions is when they eat the bird.
Okay. Well, the show's really good. But he wants to buy a football team. And there's some line in there about how that's how we knight people in the United States. Like, that's... We don't have titled aristocracy in the United States. You get your title by owning a sports team. That you kind of get led into the club of the wealthiest individuals. And it's one of the problems Chris Hansen has. He wants to be in that club. They don't really want him there. They don't really consider him to be worthy of being in the club of 30 people that get to own NBA teams. He has a profession that they're not particularly enamored with. He's a hedge fund manager. And they don't want them as part of their club. I think that should be enough for an NFL owner or any other kind of an owner, and I'm always kind of grossed out when they talk about the need for profit.
Well, why should you ask them to draw the line when we're not asking the players to draw the line?
What do you mean?
Because there's a certain point in this country at which your quality of life is enough, where you can say, hey, why, you know, this is just for fun and I don't really need that much more money.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't you say the same thing to a player?
A million different reasons. I mean, first of all, the players are much more unique. They have a skill set that we want, right? The owners are just, they have money. The players have a skill set that we actually want to pay to see.
But the owners, I mean, look, I know some of them have been handed their money, but some of them are smart businessmen.
Absolutely.
Some of them have business acumen that we don't have.
But in other businesses. I'm happy for them. I'm not sitting here telling you that the owner shouldn't make money in their life. Go make your $2 billion. I'm just saying, if I were an owner, I would get into owning a sports franchise not to make an extra couple of bucks on the side, but for fun. It's a hobby. It's not a business to me. If I'm an owner, I'm treating it as a hobby. But I already have my business.
But they got to where they are by being who they are.
I understand that. I'm telling you, if I were there and I had made my $2 billion in my business, the team would be my hobby. And
I
would be more concerned with
like
winning
that.
Than I would with making money off of it.
Right. And I do agree with Stacey is that there are owners that genuinely do look at that they get into this sports management as a hobby, as something that they've been passionate about, which... Here's the thing. I don't have a problem with owners making money. They got there for a reason. They own the team, you know, whatever. It's the next level of greed that really bothers me, of where you're trying to make so much more money that now there's so little give to the players that you're just kind of taking them, right? And it's weird to say that because they are making millions of dollars, and that's why it's hard for the average right. consumer
the
to
well, and it's the way really it's done in a shady, sympathize. Shady way. Like part Always. Of the CBA says gambling definitions that ensure money is included in the player's definition of all revenue. So gambling is about to be legalized, and we're going to make so much money from that, but we aren't going to tell you how much we're going to give you.
Right.
We're just going to make sure that in your definition of all revenue, there will be something there that ties itself to gambling.
And
that's probably why we're in such a hurry to get you to sign this.
And they steamroll the union and every opportunity they have. So look, Tom, I understand what you're saying. How much is enough enough? The players already make a lot more than you or I are ever going to see in our lifetimes. But the flip side of that is that the players are taking a physical risk, especially in football, that they have done a certain type of work and throughout their high school, college careers to get to this point. And they've concentrated on the goal of getting there almost to the extent where it can hurt their abilities to get other. Look at Jake. Jake's not qualified to do anything other than this. Poor Jake. He's not qualified for a real job. All he can do as a fallback is work with us.
That's right.
Think about how sad poor Jake's life is. That's why you've got to pay these guys.
It's ridiculous.
When they make it. Otherwise, he's stuck sitting around with you and Stacey. It's terrible.
Okay. I'm a great time.
there's a lot of things I'd rather do, but this is all I can do.
I know, it's poor. He made the decision to work out instead of studying. And now poor Jake is here. He doesn't know anything. He can't speak English well. It's very sad. He doesn't know math.
It is. It's hard. But it's funny, and you laugh at me, but it is this hard thing that I go through every day.
Right.
But here's a text that came through on the text line. But Jake, it's the owners who have allowed the players to make this kind of money in the first place. Am I wrong? Yes, you are wrong. It is the players' talent that have gotten them to this point. And it's the players' talent, yes, the ownership from long ago have helped build this industry into what it is today, but ultimately the product on the field is what sells. And so, yeah, you're wrong.
Well, and I feel like people have a hard time accepting that it's something you don't have, like the general you, that like you don't have the talent to do that. And that's why this person's getting paid more than you.
Well, I'd say it's not just talent, it's leverage, right? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Because every time we dig into these conversations about unions and CBA fights, everyone always says, well, in my job, if I do this, I'll get you'll get replaced.
Yep.
You don't have any leverage. I don't know what to tell you. There's five other people who could do your job tomorrow. That's just...
Okay, so why should that person sympathize with the players then? Why should they have any opinion on it?
They don't have. I'm not saying they have to sympathize with the players.
Okay.
I do, because I think the players are using the leverage they have to try to get as much of a share as they can, and that the owners, who are already, first of all, are already generationally wealthy beyond belief and are already taking an enormous percentage and making a tremendous amount of money, are looking for that extra little bit, and I don't understand why. The last part that you always have to remember when talking about the value of sports teams is that it's not just the yearly operating profit. It's how much in value that team increases year over year. Sports teams consistently gain value year after year. And so when an owner tells you, well, you know, I broke even for 3 straight years, 5 straight years, 10 straight years, yes, you did. But at the same time, the value of your team might have doubled in that time. So you're right. You didn't make additional income, but your team might have gone from $500 million to $1 billion valuation, and now that's all part of your net worth.
Well, and chances are you did a lot of renovations and a lot of things to also kind of – it wasn't just sitting there, and that was the cost of maintaining a budget. You probably rebuilt your stadium or you rebuilt parts of it.
Things that you're making money off of.
Totally.
Absolutely true. So, look, I will generally side with players in this. And that's not to say that I'll always side with players' unions and the decisions they make. And I think the players are wrong when they try to force things that will weaken the quality of the game. I wish the players would look at what they did and how the lack of practice and lack of off season, how it's hurt the quality of the game and actually probably led to more injuries. I think they'd be smart to go back on some of those things and put them, you know, change them in the new CBA. But I don't think they will.
Have a great weekend, Mikey.
You guys too.
By the way, I love your, what do you call that thing?
It's a vest. It's a vest day. Today's a vest day.
Were you trying to say vest?
It's a good look.
Today's just a wardrobe change. He wasn't wearing that vest I saw you 20 minutes ago.
I just went outside to grab lunch. I got a banh mi sandwich.
Was it to impress us?
Across the street, and I was still cold, so I
got it.
I was about to call it a sweater vest, but it's obviously not a sweater
vest. No, it's a puffer vest.
It's a puffer vest.
Puffer vest.
Yeah. It's an REI special.
All right. Well, enjoy your weekend.
See you guys.
This hour of Tom, Drake, and Stacey brought to you by Car Toys. Up next, did the Seahawks make a mistake with Jermaine Ifedi? Probably. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
What are we going to do at right tackle? What are we going to do at right tackle? What are we going to do at right tackle? Are we going to panic?
No, we're not going to panic, because I think right now they're in a spot that I think they have control over. But the only problem is that people could panic. And I was actually asked this question when I was doing Blue 42, filling in for Brock Huard on Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant's show. I was asked this question about if Jermaine Ifedi, they let him go, and the Seahawks go out and sign Jack Conklin. Is that a sign that the Seahawks made a mistake?
Made a mistake with what? By not signing Jermaine Ifedi when they had a chance to?
By not signing Jermaine Ifedi.
Or extending him, I should say.
Giving him a fifth-year option at a reasonable, manageable price, which would have been around $10 million, for a right tackle, that would have been manageable to do. Now, Jack Conklin is a significant upgrade over Jermaine Ifedi. Now, Jack Conklin is going to receive top dollar in free agency. Is he worth that type of contract? My answer, my immediate answer would be that he is not worth a, if I was comparing all the right tackles in the league, he would not be worth that, you know, that top end type of contract. But hey, this is the NFL. Every time a top player like Jack Conklin comes around, you know, usually you get a raise in that positional salary. So I still think that it would be a great move for the Seahawks to take Jack Conklin if they were to go that route. The problem is they're not going to do that because they don't have enough money to fill the needs that they want to fill, which is the defensive line and edge rushers in particular. So now you're in a situation where you're trying to fill your right tackle position, and it's got to be the only way it's successful and the only way that it makes sense to not give Jermaine Ifedi that fifth-year option is if you find a cheaper, better option and solution. And is that out there?
What about George Fant?
I think George Fant could potentially, but he's an unknown.
Yeah, I know he's an unknown.
He's a complete unknown.
Well, there's
unknown.
Also a chance he could want to test the market because it would be a more lucrative job to be a starting left tackle somewhere. And he kind of hinted on Twitter, like subtweeted, that that's what he could want. And so there's a chance he could, as much as I truly think, and I think all of us truly think, Pete Carroll loves his role with Seattle, he could and maybe should test the market first. So that's not a guaranteed. You could end up with legitimately a new face at right tackle.
Right, just nothing because both of those guys hit free agency, and then you're left with zilch.
Correct.
And so you're saying we go through the draft. Because you don't think that they're going to overpay at that position, nor do I. I think that if you're going to overpay, you're going to overpay at the pass rush position, and then that's probably it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, I in terms of the offensive line, I would love and think that they need to go and get another very quality type of player, whether that's a young, talented right tackle through the draft or whether that's a proven commodity that would be an upgrade over Jermaine Ifedi. That they have to get done, or they could get a really good – or they could get a really solid guard. They need at least three, you know, semi-proven commodities – on that offensive line, or else you're dealing with a very potentially bad situation. You could go backwards in terms of your offense. And you've got the skill players, you've got the quarterback, you've got all that, and you can't afford to do that. So it's interesting in terms of the dilemma that they are currently in. And you have to see if there is that value, and it's really hard. You know, there's just Dave Wyman always talks about this. There's not a right tackle tree that you can go out to and just pluck out a better guy.
A huge
but here,
tree.
Here is the other. Here's the other reality that we, you know, fail to, you know, address is that there's a reason why the Seahawks are as confident as they are about moving off from Jermaine Ifedi. Like, let's not act like Jermaine Ifedi was a real above average right tackle in this league. He wasn't great. He was not a high quality player that they, if he was a above average right tackle, they would have slapped that fifth year option on him, no questions asked, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So I do think it's very possible that they can upgrade at the position, not have to spend as much, and I do think ultimately the best option overall is to go through the draft because you want to spend most of your free agent capital on the defensive line.
How are you going to upgrade at that position and not spend as much? You're saying just go through the draft?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, is there, like Wyman says, where's the right tackle tree?
That it, I'm talking about from a free agency perspective.
No, I know, but now I'm talking about from the draft perspective. I mean,
it's one of the deeper position groups in the NFL draft. So this is, if you're talking about, you know, kind of lucking out here, this actually fits into a good situation for them where a position of need actually has good proven depth and good proven commodities that are, you know, guys that played at high level programs that have played in systems that can transfer over to the NFL. I think that you're better off taking another chance on a right tackle who you have under control for 4 more years to then, as we're talking about, are you patchworking the situation or are you building and developing? And now you have guys that you can actually build and develop with as an offensive line and grow together rather than try and get a stopgap guy at right tackle for 1 year.
How deep is that draft class or at that position? Is it so deep that you can go 4th round?
No.
Or is it, you have to go pretty high?
But there's going – yeah, I mean, and the luxury for the Seahawks is they've got 3 high-quality picks. There's guys that could, that will end up being in the late rounds and in the 2nd round as well.
All right, we're going to ask John Clayton about this next, a rare professor appearance on the Tom, Jake, and Stacey Show. That's next, 710 ESPN Seattle.